We're holding the top of page 22 in Euvamus, near the beginning of Oiskov Vav. Learning various things about good wives and not such good wives and Sholem Bayis or lack thereof. So the Gemara continues on the subject. Omar Rava, Isha Ra Mitzvah Lagasha, a bad wife of the kind that we were talking about yesterday, where she insults and curses and whatever her husband, Mitzvah Lagasha, it's a mitzvah to divorce her. Shenema, dichtiv, as the pasuk says, Goresh leitz v'yetzin modern. Goresh leitz, throw out, expel the leitz, the scoffer, as we talked about yesterday. Marashah explains that when she acts in the way that we talked about yesterday, where she prepares him food, but then she curses him out or whatever, then this is, and these are examples of letzonos, of not taking things seriously the way they're supposed to be. So then she's a let. V'yetzei modern, let the arguments go away. V'yishbos din v'kolayin, and the judgments and the embarrassment will stop. So in other words, when you have somebody who acts like that, they're like, let's then better to divorce and then and be and not have the trouble anymore. Ion Yaakov points out that this would apply even usually we say Ishto Rishona. We have the famous thing a man divorces his first wife and even the Mizbeach cries for him, but nevertheless Rava is saying that in this case that may have to be done. As we talked about yesterday, really depends also, are we talking about that the fault is entirely hers, or are we talking about that the husband usually, of course, when there's a lot of times when there's problems, then it's from both sides. But anyway, but Omar Rava, also Rava says in this connection, Isha ro ksubasa meruba, when he has a bad wife, but also she has a very large ksuba and he can't afford to pay it off, tsarasa betzida. Then what you should do is have a tzara near her. In other words, Robert's suggestion is marry another wife, and that way that will make her realize that she better shape up. Tosfos points out at the end of the perek, Rava himself points out that a man is allowed to marry many wives without needing permission from his first wife. We have Cherem de'Aveinu Gershom eventually, that was hundreds of years later. Even among the Sfardim, it eventually became common, even though in general in their original lands, they didn't accept Cherem de'Aveinu Gershom. It actually became common in those lands that when a man got married, they would write a clause into the ksuba saying that he's pledging to not take another wife without his first wife's permission. But here, Rava is talking about before you had any of these takanas. Da Amri Inchi, and Rava says, like people say, Bechavata v'lo b'silta. A woman may be more willing to accept rebuke or to just to realize by comparison that she's not being so good from another woman, v'lo b'silta, rather than with a thorn. So, like in other words, you would think you pricked with a thorn, it's going to make you wait. I should stop doing this. But Rava is saying that having another woman who either will tell her or will show her in word or in deed how she's not acting properly, or that she herself will realize that now I'm losing my status in the household or whatever. So that itself that may help her shape up. The Meiri actually says doesn't necessarily mean actually go and marry another wife, means basically make her think you're going to. And that alone, the fear of that, the Gemara elsewhere has an expression, Eina ishim eskana ela b'yerech chaverta. A woman is jealous with the thigh of a fellow woman, meaning, in other words, when she realizes that she's going to have to compete for her husband's affection and his tashmish and whatever with another wife, then that itself may cause her to act differently. V'omar Rava, also Rava says in this connection, Kosha Isha Ra Kiyem Sagrir. A bad wife is as difficult for her husband as a stormy day. Rashi says Sagrir is a it comes from a Lashon HaPosik. The Gemara is going to quote now. It's Meloshon Sogar, like closed up, like it's the kind of day when you have to stay closed up indoors because the weather is hard to go out in. Rashi describes, for example, a day of hail and wind. So an Isha Ra is as bad as that. Shenemar, as the pasuk says, Delef Toded Biyom Sagrir, a constant dripping, like when you have a leak in the like when you have a leak in the roof, and then you have a constant dripping in your house on a stormy day. The Eishes Medonim and a quarrelsome wife, Nishtava, are the same thing. So in other words, Shlomo HaMelech is comparing that they're comparable one to another. The point being, Maharshal says it's not so much that you would think without Rava telling. What do you need Rava to tell you? On how you can read the pasuk yourself. The answer is without Rava telling you, you would think the comparison is to an annoying leak. But Rava is saying no. The comparison is really to the stormy day. You can't go outside on a day like that. The weather is too bad. So the same way, a husband in this situation, he's stuck and he can't easily get out of this situation.
You can stay inside and fix the leak.
You can stay inside and fix the leak. But the point is, well, usually you have to go outside. You have to go up onto the roof to fix it. But the point is, the comparison is not so much to the leak. The comparison is to the stormy weather that prevents you from going out in the same way he's stuck in this situation and he can't easily get out of it. Also there's the point, the Maharal makes the point also, like usually when you have stormy weather like that, it also usually makes people feel more depressed. A person feels usually more lighthearted and tolerant and whatever when it's a sunny day. And then on the other hand, when you have a stormy day like that, less so, in the same way an Isha Ra has such an effect on her husband's mentality and on his feelings and so forth. I once saw actually a Gleich Vertel on it. Also, somebody said, I don't remember who, that the point of the pasuk is also, so maybe the comparison is to the leak. The point is, a leak only bothers you on a rainy day. When it's a sunny day, the leak's not a problem. As opposed to an Eishes Medonim, the Shtava, it's always equal. It's always the same thing, no matter what the weather is.
Can't escape.
Rava also says, come see how good, what a bracha it is from Hashem to have a good wife, become a ra isha ra, and vice versa, how bad it is to have a bad wife. Kama tova isha tova, dichtiv, as you have the pasuk that we quoted several times in the Gemara yesterday, matza isha matza tova. A man has found a wife, he's found good. And in particular, now that doesn't necessarily say that she's an Isha Tova. Marashah points out at the end of the pasuk, "Vayofik Rotzen MeHashem," where he brings out favor from Hashem, meaning that it shows that Hashem has favored him. That clearly shows we're talking about an Isha Tova. We also learned yesterday, "Vayofik" also is Meloshin Poikikin, that is Averis are sealed up and hidden away. And the pasuk is saying, so you have to consider, says Rava, what is the pasuk referring to? You can say on one level that many, many psukim in Mishlei are meant to be understood on two or more levels. That's why it's called Mishlei, which means like a mushel. So you have the surface meaning of the pasuk, and then you delve below the surface and you find that it's talking about something else. So here, if you take the pasuk on its surface meaning that it's talking about a good wife, well then you can see kama tova isha tova shakosu mashabcha. Well then see how good a good wife is that the pasuk praises her. And ibatoda mishtoikra, you could instead understand that the pasuk is referring to Torah. We actually have today's Tanya, where halachas and Torah are compared to Eishes Chayil, and you have many other places. The whole Eishes Chayil that we say Friday night is also one of the many meanings of it. Is it's a metaphor for the Torah. The Torah is often compared to a wife. So if you're going to say that you're going, Rava says, if you're going to go below the surface and you're going to say that the isha, that matzah isha of the pasuk is referring to a person who learns Torah, well then kama tova isha tova. Well then, look how good a good wife is. Shat Torah nimshalaba, that she can be used as a moshul for the Torah. And the point is, in other words, Maharsha says that the idea is supposed to be that Rambam mentions that a person when he's learning Torah should be so into it, like the Rambam describes, like you have a person who's in love with a woman, and like he can't think of anything else, like all his thoughts are constantly of her. That's the way it should be with a yid in Torah. Now, on the other hand, Kama Ra Isha Ra, look how bad a bad wife is, Rava continues. Dichtiv, the pasuk that we quoted before, Umoitzani Mar Mimavas Isha, that Shlomo also says, I found even more bitter than death is a wife. And the pasuk continues to describe, we're talking about a wife who causes trouble. And Marashah, by the way, earlier points out the first time the Gemara brought this pasuk that, in the simple sense, in context of the pasuk in Kehelas, it's talking about an Eishes Ish who seduces a man into being mezana with her. But nevertheless, the Gemara is understanding. But then the question is, why would that be more Marmi Mavist more than any other? There's 20 or so Arayas, so an Eishes Ish is only one of them. So therefore, the Gemara prefers to understand it about an Isha Ra who makes life so difficult for her husband that he wishes he was dead. Again, if you're going to say the pasuk is talking about on the surface meaning, it's talking about a woman like that, about a wife like that, then the point is, kamara isha ra shakosa magana. Then look how bad it is that the pasuk takes the time to condemn her. You could also say, instead, looking at it in a deeper level, that the pasuk is hinting at gehenim, that a person might end up in if he follows his yetzahara. Then the point is, kamara isha ra shegehenim nimshalaba. Well, then come see how bad a bad wife is that gehenim can be compared to her. So, and Marshall explains, in other words, then the point is that so you would say that death brings about the physical death as the death of the body. But here we're talking about the Pasuk maybe hinting at Gehenim, which is where the neshama dies, and therefore, in that sense, it's worse. It's Marmi Mavis, even more bitter than death. There is also the point. There is also the point. By the way, the Gemara mentions there's a Gemara in Eruvin that mentions that when a man suffers from an ishara, he's not going to end up seeing Gehenim. So therefore, that also fits with this over here that we're saying that the ishara herself can be compared to Gehenim, and therefore he's experienced it during his lifetime, and therefore he doesn't need it after 120. In this connection, the Gemara brings a pasuk. The Navi Yirmiyah says about the Jewish people, "Hinani mevi elehem ra." Behold, I am going to bring on them an evil asher lo yuchlu lotzes mimena, that they will not be able to go out of it. So, in the simple sense, it's talking about that Hashem is going to bring against them Nebuchadnezzar, and he's going to conquer them, and they're going to be stuck and not going to be able to get out of Golos. But the Gemara is also seeing it as hinting at this problem of an isha ra. Amr of Nachman, Amr of Bavur, zu isha ra ksubas meruba. Again, when he has a bad wife and she has a large ksuba, and therefore he can't eat, and therefore he can't afford to divorce her, then that's a ra that he can't get out of. So Marashah explains the comparison is the same way as you have, for example, the Nebuchadnezzar and the other enemies of the Jewish people are dominating over us, and we have no ability to get out from under their control. The same way it is with a guy who has an isha ra, and she lords it over him. We mentioned the other day, for example, briefly, we mentioned Rabbi Yossi Aglili, where it's mentioned in a Medrash that he had that kind of situation. He had an ishara, and the upshot of it was there was a large ksuba, and he couldn't afford it. The Medrash describes how Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah helped him out, because Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, as we know from many Gemaras, was extremely rich, so he was able to help out Rabbi Yossi Aglili with that. By the way, when we said at the top of the Omud, ishara mitzvah legarsha, so what about? We had several examples yesterday of Chachamim. We had Reb Chiya, we had Rav. According to one way of looking at it, we had Rabbi Yehuda, who had wives that were difficult to get along with, and yet they didn't divorce them. Why not? So there's a couple of explanations. One explanation is, in those cases, they had children with their wife. That's different. When Rava is saying Isha Ra, Mitzvah L'Garsha, he doesn't necessarily mean when there were children involved. Another answer is that in each of those cases, yes, they were an Isha Ra, but they also had some redeeming qualities. In the case of Rabbi Yehuda's wife, we said that she got angry very easily, but she also calmed down very easily. And the same thing with Rav's and Rabchia's respective wives. They weren't always so great to them, but they had certain good qualities. When Rava is saying Isha Ra Mitzvah L'Garsha, we're talking about where there's no good qualities at all. And even then, you know, you can always go see if some marriage counseling might do some good. All right. The pasuk, another pasuk in this connection, talking about troubles that we can't easily get out of. Pasuk in Eicha says, "Nesamnani Hashem bidei le'uchal kum." Hashem has placed me into the hands, into the power of someone where I can't even get up. Again, to get out of the trouble. Same thing. Same thing. That pasuk is also hinting at the situation of a man who is married to an ishara with a large ksuba, where therefore not only he's placed into the hands, he's placed under the control of somebody where he can't get up and get out of it, because he can't divorce her because he can't afford to pay off her ksuba. In the West, meaning in Eretz Yisrael, they gave a different explanation. Amri, they said, Zeshem is a noise of Tluyin Bekaspoi. Another meaning of that pasuk, Nosanani Hashem Bidele Uchakum, it's not just, again, each of these psukim, this and the previous pasuk, Hinni Mevi'ele Ra, in the simple sense, they're talking about on the national level, the Jewish people. But here we're explaining that it also can refer in the individual level to what happens to an individual. So in the Marova, in the West, in Eretz Yisrael, they explain that means it has another meaning as well, when you have a person whose money, who's mizonus, whose food depends on his money. Meaning, we've been learning here and there the last couple of days that on the one hand, it's not so great for a person to be engaged in farming as his whole parnasa. On the other hand, a person should have a small plot of land where he can grow food for his family. So now we're saying if he doesn't have that, if he has to depend on buying food in the store, then you never know, prices may go up. Or there may be shortages or whatever, and therefore he's constantly nervous. Therefore, Nesamnani Hashem bidei le'uchakum, Hashem has placed me such a person in a situation where he can't get out of it, because he may always be in trouble if there's a problem with the food supply or with the prices or whatever. The Meiri has a different explanation. He has a slightly different girsa over here. He explains it means a person who earns money, but he doesn't invest any of it. If he invests some of it, then at least he has. He'll be earning money from that. But if he's just earning basically just enough to make ends meet, then that's a problem, because then he has he's not enlarging. He doesn't have the ability to enlarge his assets, and that's what the Gemara is referring to over here. Elsewhere, by the way, the Gemara mentions other psukim in that connection. Also, there's a Gemara, I think, in Menachos and maybe in other places as well, that mentions that also you have psukim in the Teuchacha, near the end of the Teuchacha in Parshas Kisavai, that also refer to this kind of thing, a person who doesn't have a field to grow his own grain, so he has to buy it wholesale or retail, or even worst of all, he doesn't have even the ability to buy that, and he actually has to buy bread from the baker, where in all those cases, his life is in constant suspense, because all you need is something goes wrong with the supply chain and he goes hungry. All right, continuing on this topic, the Gemara continues in Oischof Zayin. Here's a pasuk from the Torah in this connection. The Torah warns, the part of the Torah, your sons and your daughters will be given over to another nation. So now, in a simple sense, it means exactly that. That, in other words, there are going to be goyim that are going to be conquering and then taking Jewish children captive. But Marsha points out in earlier psukim, it mentions the word la'ivecha, to your enemies. So why all of a sudden there's a change over here to la'am acher? So therefore, the Gemara says, Amar of Chanan bar Rava, Amar Rav, zu eshe sa'av. This refers to when a father of children has to remarry because his first wife died or he divorced her, and then she, as a stepmother to the children, is not always so good to them. So it's not an enemy per se, but nevertheless, it's am acher of a family of a mother who comes from a different family. Marsha points out, we find the word am being used, for example, of the individual shvatim. So am acher can mean a different family. Iyun Yaakov also points out that there's a Gemara in Shabbos that says Noshim Am Bifnei Atzman, women relative to men are like a separate nation. Because you think about it, you know, all of us know men and women have very different ways of thinking and then doing things or whatever. So it's almost like you meet somebody from a foreign nation. So in that sense, then the Eisha Sa'av, the stepmother over here, can be called Am Acher in the pasuk. Another one, here's another pasuk in this connection. This is from Parshas Hazinu. The pasuk says, Hashem warns, Begoy novel ach isem. I'm going to anger them, and I'm going to cause the Jewish people to be angered and upset by a novel nation. Novel means degenerate or low class or whatever. So what does that mean? So here we have several explanations. So first, Amar of Chanan bar Rava, Amar Rav, again, Zu Isha Roh, Ksubas Meruba. This is yet another pasuk referring to the bad wife with the large ksuba. So it's novel in the sense that, as we said before, she curses out her husband, so she uses Nivul Peh against him. So therefore she can be called Begoy Novel. And again, the point is that Achisem, Hashem is saying, the husband is going to be angered by her in the sense that he has to put up with it because he's not able to divorce her because he can't afford to pay her ksuba. Now here we have several other explanations. Rabbi Lozo Omer Elo Atzdukim. Rabbi Lozo says another meaning of Begoy Novel Achisem, who is this Goy Novel, refers to the Tzdukim. This is actually, the word Tzdukim is actually a change by the censor. It's really supposed to be Haminim. And minim includes various, I mean, Zukim, we know, famously didn't believe in Torah Shabbat Peh. Minim includes various people who don't believe in certain fundamentals of Yiddishkeit that Amam classifies among the 13 midis, among the 13 ikrim of Yiddishkeit that Amam formulated. You have a few of them where if a person denies them, he's called a min, and a few other ones where if he denies them, he's called an apikodis, etc. So a min includes, for example, somebody who doesn't believe in Hashem at all, or who believes that there are two gods, or that Hashem has a body, and several other categories like that. Minim also often in the Gemara often includes also the early Christians who had ideas like that. So now Rabbi Lozer is saying that the goy novel of our posik is referring to those kinds of people. Because again, no novel, Maloshin Nibol Peh, they're speaking in a derogatory way against Hashem. They're speaking and claiming false things about what Hashem is.
When was the Talmud finished?
The Talmud Bavli was finished around the year 4260 on the Jewish calendar, which is 500 CE. So yeah, by that time, Christianity already existed for a couple hundred years. I mean, here we're talking about Lazar, who lived a few hundred years before that. But yeah, in his times already, it wasn't yet the official religion of the Roman Empire. But by that time, you had a fair number of people who were already following it. Yeah. So V'chein Hu'omer, as the pasuk says, Omer Novel Belibur Ein Elokim, the novel, the degenerate person, says in his heart, there's no God. So therefore, so that refers to these minim who have such mistaken ideas about Hashem. B'masnisetana, in a braisa, we learn the goy novel of the pasuk refers to yet another group. Elu anshe barbaria v'anshe mastanai or martanai, it refers to the people of Barbaria and Martanai. These are places in North Africa. Barbaria, you have there's a parts of North Africa are called the Barbary Coast, named after that, and then Mauritania was the Romans had named an area which is more or less nowadays parts of Morocco. They called it Mauritania. So those Bapashtos are the two places that the Gemara is referring to over here. Shemahalchen Arumim Bashuk, the people of those places walk around naked or underdressed in the marketplace. There's nobody more disgusting and abhorrent to Hashem more than somebody who does that. Because then that way, they're not even acting like a human being. They're acting more like an animal. In fact, you have. If a person does that, then he's possible edus. Tosfos elsewhere, the Gemara brings that in Kiddushin, I think. Tosfos points out, doesn't mean where the guy's walking around stark naked. I mean, then he's a shoyter, he's posulatus on that ground. It means, let's say, for example, you know, sometimes you have people are doing hard work in the street and they do it shirtless or whatever. We're talking about people like that, where they're severely underdressed, but it's a bizoyan for themselves, the way that they're even a human being, even a goy, should have a certain self-respect and a certain dignity to wear clothes in public, and these people aren't doing that. So that's another meaning of goy novel achi, saying that Hashem is saying that I'm going to cause the Jewish people to be harassed by such low, degenerate people like that. Rabbi Yochanan Amar Elu Chavraya. Rabbi Yochanan says yet another meaning of goy novel is the Chavraya. Now, who are they? So it's like this. The Gemara mentions them in a number of places in connection with the Persians. So there's one place where Rashi says that the Chavraya themselves are the Persians, but most of the Rashi himself elsewhere and most of the other Mephoshim explain that no, the Chavraya are a subgroup of the Persians. So specifically what it is that it comes out, the Aruch brings from the Marsha, brings from the Aruch, that they were, in particular, they were the Persian priests. Now you had during the period of the Gemara. Nowadays Iran is Muslim, but back then, before Islam came along, their national religion is called Zoroastrianism. They worshipped fire. They had a whole concept of two gods: a god of good and a god of evil. The Gemara mentions it sporadically here and there. Their priests, their galochim, were called Chavri. So and we find in various places in the Gemara that they caused a lot of trouble to the Jews living under Persian rule, which includes the Jews above all. So they're the novel, they're the goy novel that we're saying again that they're acting in disgusting ways towards the Jewish people and towards Hashem. And therefore, the goy novel achisim then is Rabbi Yochanan is saying is referring to them that Hashem is going to put the Jewish people under their power. In fact, in that connection, the Gemara says, Omer le Rabbi Yochanan osu chavri lebavel. They told him, now Rabbi Yochanan lived his whole life in Eretz Yisrael, but they told him at one point, the chavri have come to Bavel. Historically, what happened was like this. During the time of the, there was the Persian Empire of Kodesh and Ahasuerus and Daryavesh that was conquered and defeated by Alexander the Great. Eventually the Persians managed to make themselves independent of that. They had a kingdom for a couple of hundred years over there. It's called the Parthian Empire. They had this religion of Zoroastrianism was their national religion, but they didn't make such a big deal about it. They were pretty tolerant. Now, in the time of Rabbi Yochanan, around the beginning of the time of the Amoraim, there was a revolution over there, and a new group came to power. Where the new king over there founded a new dynasty over there was himself one of these Persian galochim, one of the chavri. So therefore, for a while, there was serious trouble for the Jews of Bavel. So now Rabbi Yochanan in Eretz Yisrael is being informed of what's going on in Bavel, that now the chavri have taken over. They've taken over the government. Shoga nafal. He bent over and he fell down. He felt such tsar. What's going to happen to the Jews above all, which is one of the major centers of Jewish life in the world nowadays? What's going to happen to them, ruled over by the Chavri, who are very intolerant? Omer lei, but then they told Rabbi Yochanan, Mekabli Sheikhta. These guys are corrupt. They're willing to accept bribes. Shrit Yosef, then he sat back up straight and he realized in that case, then Jewish life will continue to be able to flourish in Babel. They're just they're going to have to grease some palms over there, but they're going to be able to continue to live without too much trouble. Kahava, for the most part. It's an old story, yeah. But for the most part, actually, I mean, this dynasty over there in history, it's called the Sasanian dynasty, ended up ruling Persia for about 400 years until the Muslims conquered it. And during most of those 400 years, it's true that the Jews got along fairly well over there. There was a period, Reb Shuta Goyen mentions in his Igeres, and there's various other sources that mention that towards in the last 100 or 150 years, they started causing a lot of trouble for the Jews, and there were Shmudis and Xeris and whatnot. But overall, during the time of the Amoraim, for the most part, they got along well enough. There's actually a different girsa. The Magid Mishnah and the Rambam points out. The Rambam brings a halacha that when you have various things for which the Chachamim should declare fasts and tefillah and extra tefillahs and things like that. And one of them is when a government comes into power. Then when a local government comes into an anti-Semitic local government comes into power. So the Magen Mishnah points out, apparently the Rambam got that from our Gemara over here, and that it wouldn't be Rabbi Yochanan, who lived in Eretz Yisrael, who said this, but rather one of the Chachamim in Bavel, that he's davening to Hashem to save the local Jews from the Chavri, and therefore we have a precedent for this concept that this is the kind of thing to declare fasts and then things like that for.
Now, why it says in Perkei Avos to pray for the welfare of the government.
So there is something else, daven for the welfare of the government, even if it's anti-Semitic and whatever, because Ish Yisrael Chaim Bloy. But on the other hand, when such a government comes to power, then yeah, you have to daven and ask Hashem to be freed from it. Or that they should, or leave malachim v'sarim biyad Hashem, or to have them like we have over here, where as long as they're willing to accept shoychad, then you can manage to live under them. Yeah. So the Gemara continues. With three gzeiros that these chavri made in Bavel. Rashi seems to have the girsa. Rashi says omrulei. We don't have the words over here in front of us, but omrulei, they told Rabbi Yochanan, that they continued to inform Rabbi Yochanan, here's the news from Bavel, the Chavri have taken over, and you should know, they've declared the following three gzeiros on the Jewish people in Bavel, and in the Persian kingdom. So Gozru al Shloisha, they made gzeiros on three things, and Rabbi Yochanan explained to them, Mipnei Shloisha. The reason is because the Jews over there are being careless with three mitzvahs, and Keneged that, therefore the Eibishter is bringing these three gzeiros on them. Gozru al Abosar, the first one they told them, they made a gzera that they're not allowed to shecht and eat animals. They're not allowed to eat meat. So he explains, Mipnei matonis. The reason is because they're not giving the matonis of Zroi l'chayayi v'keva that are supposed to be given to the Kohenim. So there is some discussion about that. You're going to say the Jews of Bavel, which includes many great Chachamim, they're not going to keep a mitzvah that it says right there in the Torah. So there's a couple of possibilities. The Aruch HaNer and various other Mefoshim talk about, first of all, there's an opinion in a Gemara in Chulin that says that mitzvah doesn't apply outside Eretz Yisrael. Now, that's not the halacha. The halacha is it applies everywhere. But nevertheless, the Jews of Bavel may have been relying on the opinion that says that it doesn't apply in Bavel. But Rabbi Yochanan is holding that against them because why are you using a tatum like that and not doing the mitzvah? The fact is, by the way, nowadays also, you don't often see that people give Zroi L'Chayayim V'Keva to the Kohen. There are people who are tackle working to strengthen the observance of the mitzvah. There are various things, there are various rationales that posts can give for why not to be so careful with it, but nevertheless, it's still better to do it.
Commercial
ones also have to do it. So there's the idea of the Kohenim HaMoichol, and there's various other possibilities. We don't have any Kohenim Miyuchosim, so we don't know for sure 100% that any particular Kohen is a Kohen, but these are all Heterim. They're Anyway, so Rabbi Yochanan is saying that this is the problem with the Jews in Bavel. The second one, and then actually the Chassam Sofer has a very interesting explanation about it. He says, don't just mean the matonis of Zroi L'Chayayim V'Keva. Like this, that's one of the 24 matonis that are given to Kohenim. And what's the idea? Is that the Kohenim are supposed to be the ones who teach Torah to the Jewish people. Yodom Shpatech L'Yakov V'Serosch L'Yisrael. And therefore, so they're supposed to be provided with their parnasa so that they're able to learn and teach Torah full time. Well, then the Chassam Sofer says, so we don't just mean that in Bavel they weren't giving these matnas kohuna. We mean that they weren't supporting the Talmud Chachamim. And therefore, Rabbi Yochanan says, as a result of that, therefore, these chavri are making a gzera against them that they can't eat meat. So the Chassam Sofer says, he says, you see it in our times as well. He mentions in his own time also, he says there were people weren't being careful enough to support the Talmud Chachamim. And sure enough, the government of his time, the government of Austria-Hungary at one point also made a gzera against Shrita. So they go together.
Nowadays, Europe is also.
Yeah, nowadays in Europe, you also have, yeah, some such xeris have happened over and over in Jewish history, and Rabbi Yochanan is saying he was the underlying reason for it. The Aruch HaSholem, by the way, points out that based on what we know historically and religiously and whatever of the Zoroastrian beliefs, then we can understand from their point of view what they were thinking with these Xeris. They had an idea like all animal life is sacred and you shouldn't be killing unnecessarily, like PETA nowadays or whatever. But yeah, but Rabbi Yochanan is saying the real reason behind it is this reason that he's saying about the Matanis. The second one, Gozra al Mechatzois. They made a gzera there in Bavel that the Jews can't use the bathhouses over there. So Rabbi Yochanan, they can't use the bathhouses.
Oh.
Yeah. So Rabbi Yochanan explains b'nei tevila. The reason is because they're not being careful with toiveling. Now, again, you're going to ask, the toiveling, a woman toivels once a month, or chas v'shalom, to say that the Jews of Bavel were being careless with that. So Marashah says that maybe what it is in particular, you have the actual tevila itself, of course, they're being very careful with it. It's an isur kares otherwise. But you have midrabanan, you have to have before the tevila, there's chafifa, where the woman has to shower and scrub her body thoroughly, and that has to be shortly before the tevila, and they weren't necessarily so careful with that to do it right before the tevila. So in return, there's a Rabbi Yochanan is explaining that in return, what the Eibishter did is he caused that now they made a gzera against using the bathhouses, where those would be the places where the women would prepare for tevila. So in other words, again, it's not that they're careless with the mitzvah of tevila itself, but yeah, the Aruch HaNer also mentions that another possibility is we're not talking about tevila of women, which is a mitzvah d'oraisa, but rather we're talking about tevilas Ezra, the famous takana that Ezra made, that a balkeri should tovel in order to daven and in order to learn Torah. And the fact is, la halacha, that takana is not in effect anymore, and you're allowed to daven or learn Torah when you're a balkeri. Nevertheless, a bal nefesh is still specifically careful about it, and in Bavel they weren't, and therefore Rabbi Yochanan is holding that, is saying that the Eibishter is holding that against them.
Davening Shmona
Esrei. Yeah, primarily davening means Shmona Esrei, yeah. And the third one, by the way, as far as the Matanis, also Marashah points out another way they could get around it, for example, Al Pi Halacha, if you have a goy as a partner with you in the ownership of the animal, then you're potter from Zroi L'Chayayim V'Keva. So that would be another way that they were using to do an end run around this mitzvah, but nevertheless, Rabbi Yochanan is saying that's not the right thing to do. And the third thing, the third gzera that the Chavri were making, komachatati shachri. They're unburying, they're digging up the dead. So here also, I mean, it's, you know, all, again, all these things can be understood in terms of their religion. They have the idea that the ground is sacred and bodies shouldn't be buried in it. They themselves would put their dead out on platforms, on high platforms for birds of prey to eat them. So like this, they're trying to enforce that on the Jews as well. And the reason is, the Gemara explains, because Jews there in Bavel are rejoicing together with the Goyim on their Chagas. So now, as a result, it actually explains, so they're being happy with them on their Goyish holidays, and therefore the result is now there's this Gzera, which plunges them into mourning again, because Bechlal, when a person's relative is dug up, you actually have a halacha called Pinu, called Likur Tatzomos, that we talked about it a few days ago, that you have in those times, it was very common that you would bury a body temporarily until the flesh decayed, and then you would dig up the bones and you would put them and you'd bury them together with their ancestors in a niche, in a cave or whatever. So here, like this, when the bodies are being, there's supposed to be a one-day Avelos when that takes place. So now they're being plunged into Avelos anytime that their relatives are being unburied or being dug up by the Chavri. And the reason is, we're saying, because they were inappropriately rejoicing together with the Goyim on their Chagas. So there's a variety of, again, there's a variety of explanations how they could be makel on that in Bavel. Marashah points out, the Gemara in Avodah Zarah mentions that outside Eretz Yisrael, the Goyim aren't really that addicted to their religion anyhow. They're not so fanatical about their religion anyway. When they have their Chagas, you think about it, it's like Lahavdil, you know, you think about like nowadays with Xmas or something, they don't really think so much of the religious aspect of it. It's more like it's a nice fun day. So the Jews in Bavel would also took that view of it, and therefore they figure it's not so bad to join with the Goyim in celebrating their Chagas, but nevertheless we're saying that it's the wrong thing to do. Then there's a number of other points as well. There's a point that they're being involved with the Goyim on their holidays, and including also the Goyim often bring Karbonis on their holidays, which the Karbonis are called Zivchei Mesim. They're sacrifices to the dead, and therefore in retribution for that, then their own dead get unburied. B'chlal, there's the idea that any that averus in general make a person spiritually dead. So therefore, so it all relates. So it all relates. Shenema, as in fact the pasuk says, Shmuel warns the Jewish people that if you don't do what Hashem says, v'hoise yad Hashem b'chem uv'aviseichem, the hand of Hashem will be against you and against your ancestors. Now you can ask, you, it's impossible to understand. They're alive, and therefore Hashem could punish them in this in their lifetime. But b'aviseichem, the parents and the ancestors are already dead. How could Hashem strike them? V'omer Rav bar Shmuel zuchatot yishichvi. That refers to this kind of thing where they dig up the bodies of the dead. As in fact, the Gemara elsewhere says that because of the averus that the living people do, the dead people end up getting unburied in connection with that. And you have to ask, why is it? How could it be fair? So one answer is because the parents apparently didn't give a proper chinuch to their children, and therefore the children are not behaving the way they're supposed to, and therefore the parents end up having to go through this. And mind you, the Gemara says elsewhere actually that when a person's body is unburied, it's more of a kapara for him. So therefore, in that sense, then the parents and the ancestors to whom this is happening are having an ultimate kapara that way, at least. The Gemara, by the way, elsewhere mentions that you have technically in Beitza, I think it says, technically you have a din that if you have a mess on the second day of Yom Tov, on the first day of Yom Tov, you can only have goyim be involved with the burial. But if it's the second day of Yom Tov, technically you're allowed to have Jews do the burial. Nevertheless, the Gemara points out in Bavel they had to be careful about that because so Rashi over there explains that the reason is because if the goyim see Jews burying the dead on Yom Tov, they're going to force them to bury their own dead or to do other malachas for them on Yom Tov, and of course you're not going to be allowed to do that. But another explanation is based on this over here, that if the goyim see them bury the dead and on Yom Tov when everybody's out and about, then they're going to go and unbury them, and therefore, so you have this danger that we're mentioning over here, so therefore they would have to do it, they'd have to do it privately, they'd have to do it in secrecy. So these were all, so we're saying, these are all the various gzeiros that these chavri were imposing in Bavel, and that was why Rabbi Yochanan was so nervous about what's going to happen to the Jewish community over there until he was told that they accept Shoichad, and then he realized, okay, at least we have a way out of this mess. So in this connection, the Gemara continues on that topic. Amalei Rova l'Rabba Bamori. Siv, there's a pasuk that says, lo ye osu, the pasuk is talking about the Rishoyim towards the end of the first Beis HaMikdash, lo ye osu, they're going to die of hunger and of all kinds of other things, lo ye osu v'lo ye kaveru, they will not be gathered up, they won't be buried, l'doymin al pnei ha'adama yiyu, they will become like waste on the surface of the ground, in other words, because they're going to rot over there. Uchtiv, and the next pasuk continues, v'nivchar moves mechayim, death will be preferable to life. Now you have to ask if the people are not even going to be buried, then why would people prefer to die rather than to live? Now the simple meaning Marashah brings from Rashi over there, that it means that as bad as it's going to be for the Mesim that are going to be left unburied, the living are going to have it even worse. But the fact is that's not mentioned in the pasuk, so therefore the Gemara gives another explanation. So Rava is asking Rava Bar Mori, what does the pasuk actually mean? We find all over Shas, by the way, where Rava Bar Mori was apparently the great expert in Tanakh. So we often find that Rava and Rava and other Amiroyim would ask him to explain the meanings of Psukim in Tanakh. Anyway, so Omar Leh, he explains, Nivcha Mavis L'Rishoyim. What it means is, under such circumstances, we don't mean that people will choose, will say it's better to die than to live. What we mean is the Navi is saying it's better, the Rishoyim are better off dying under such circumstances, because otherwise, if they continue living in this world, the Yechatu, they're going to continue sinning, the Yiplu, the Gehenim, and they're going to wind up in Gehenim, so therefore they're better off dying before that happens. Like we have, for example, with the Ben Sura Ramoda, where he's executed before he really goes bad, and you have other examples like that. So the Navi is not saying people are going to make that choice, but in other words, Hashem sometimes does a chesed like that for people who otherwise are going to become worse and worse for Shoyim and takes them away from the world, so this way they don't become so bad that they wind up in Gehenim. This way, after all, they're able to come to Olam Haba. Okay. Yom Yom Mashiach Ha'Geula, Yud Ches Cheshvan. We started talking about yesterday about you have the various stages after Mashiach comes. We talked about yesterday, Yemos Mashiach, where the world is still going to, you have there's definitely going to be eating and drinking. But the question is going to be, the world is going to be functioning on Nisim, or is it the world is going to be functioning basically b'derech hateva, just that we're not going to be subject to the goyim anymore. Now you have the second stage, Gan Eden. Gan Eden is where you have neshamas without bodies. So there, obviously, there's no eating and drinking because those are only relevant to bodies. Then you have the world of Tchias HaMesim. Now, then you have Tchias HaMesim. By definition, it means neshamas in bodies. Now, you have famously, you have the machloikas about between the Rambam and the Ramban about that. What happens after Tchias HaMesim? The Rambam learns that eventually, even after Tchias HaMesim, everybody's going to die and there's going to be a world of only neshamas. The Ramban disagrees on that and says that the people who come alive at Tchias HaMesim are going to continue living forever in Gufim, but the Gufim are going to be on a much higher level. And Chassid Alter Rebbe and Torah writes according to that, and in general, Chassidus agrees with that. So now, when you have neshamas in bodies, then when Chazal say that ha'olam haba, there's no eating and drinking, so that of necessity has to be and it's saying there's no eating and drinking, so that's talking about the ultimate degree of schar. That is talking about the world after Tchias HaMesim. So there's going to be bodies, but they're not going to need to eat because they're going to be sustained by pure elikus. Okay. We start in Kitzur Shulchan Aruch and Simon Peches talking about the dinim of Muktzah. And Muktzah is pretty complicated stuff, but we have only two fairly short simonim on the subject, but there's a lot of detail packed into them. So first of all, you have what's called the first kind of one. There's several different categories of Muktzah. One is called Muktzah Midas. So you have, for example, food that you put out of mind before Shabbos because it's not edible, because it's only barely edible. It could be because it's completely inedible. It could be because it's only barely edible. You would only eat in a pinch. It could be even that it's fine, it's edible, but you have it set aside. You plan to sell it. So all those kinds of things. Most of these kinds of things, actually, you are still allowed to handle them on Shabbos. You have things, you have what's called docha b'yadayim, where you push them away b'yadayim. The classic example in Shas is, for example, grapes that you put out to dry into raisins, where until they turn into raisins, they're not really edible. So then those would be muktzah on Shabbos. But other than that, most of these other kinds of things, even you stored it away and you plan to sell it, or it's not real, it's only barely edible. I shouldn't say where it's not edible at all, where it's barely edible, or things like that, or things that you could feed to animals, even if you didn't plan to before Shabbos. Or things, for example, that it was in one state yesterday, but it became a different state today. For example, you have, let's say, a keli that broke on Shabbos, but you could still sort of use it for the original purpose. So it's not completely unusable. The Alter Rebbe actually adds, even if they're only usable for some other malacha, as long as they're usable in some sense. So another example would be bones, for example, that were separated from the meat, and you could give them to dogs. So all these kinds of things you would be allowed to handle on Shabbos, even though on the face of it, you put them out of mind. You don't plan to eat them on Shabbos. Nevertheless, they're not muktzah, and you are allowed to handle them. Again, unless dechoy be a dime, unless you actually did something with them to make them that you're not going to do anything with them on Shabbos. For example, these raisins, these grapes that you put out to make raisins.
About frozen raw meat.
So frozen raw meat. So, I mean, you can't cook raw meat on Shabbos, obviously, but you could feed it to animals. So therefore, there would possibly be reason to be able to handle it on Shabbos. So even so, if it's frozen, I mean, all it has to do is defrost. You don't have to really do much with it. I'll have to look it up for sure, but I think there may be grounds based on what we're saying over here that it might be grounds to be able to handle it on Shabbos. I'll look it up though, Blinetta.